This is Audible.
The Rational Male by Rollo Tomasi. Read by Sam Botta. Introduction. In January of 2001, I was entering a state university for the first time in my life at the ripe age of 32. My relatively late life enrollment was the result of what I believed then was a misspent youth, and I was atoning for the indiscretions of what I call my rockstar 20s. I had a lot of catching up to do thanks to the decisions I'd made in my early and mid-20s and a sense of incompleteness that I felt at the time. In hindsight, I'm glad I did return to school. Better late than never. Because I was learning the intrinsic value of an education. I can remember listening to the grumblings of guys in my class who were 10 years my junior saying, "What the hell do I need to learn this shit for? It won't help me in the job I'm studying for." I suppose I might have felt the same way at 22 if I hadn't been more concerned with playing the next gig in the next band I was in on a weekend in Hollywood. I could never have appreciated the value of being an educated person. While a good job is definitely a concrete goal of bettering oneself, being educated on a great many subjects and learning how to learn is its own reward. Although I didn't attend a liberal arts university per se, my degree is in fine art. However, after having worked in design, advertising, marketing, and branding throughout my professional life, I knew that my minor, if later a double major, had to be in psychology. My initial interest in psychology was due to the want of a better understanding of the often difficult personalities I was forced to deal with in my career. So personality studies and behaviorism was a natural fit for me. Much of what I have compiled in this book is the direct result of over a decade of applying these schools of psychology to the gender dynamics I've experienced personally, as well as the collective experiences of millions of men around the world. Connecting dots. While I was studying psychology, I felt a natural attraction toward behaviorism. Like most people, I was peripherally familiar with the more touchy-feely branches of psychology, like psychoanalysis, and the sit-down-on-the-couch-and-let's-talk-about-feelings applications most people associate with psychology. Behaviorism was a much more concrete approach, one based on behaviors and the motivators for them. One of the primary foundations of game awareness is basing your estimation of a woman upon her actions and behaviors rather than her words or implied intents. This principle is founded in behaviorism's cardinal principle. Behavior is the only reliable evidence of motivation. Even motivations not consciously recognized by the actor can influence behavior regardless of a consciously rationalized motive. In other words, sometimes we don't realize why we're hypocrites or saints, as the case may be. Coming to terms with this behavioral foundation was the first dot I connected between hard psychology and intergender dynamics. For roughly a year or two before I enrolled, I'd been actively posting on a few online forums attempting to help some young men with their girl problems. Initially, these forums weren't in any way related to what would later become the community or game-oriented in nature. I'd heard of the early pickup artists like Mystery and a few others, but they weren't promoting anything I hadn't already known from my more libertine rockstar 20s. I was more interested in helping these guys not make the mistakes, for much of the same reasons, with women that I had. However, I just couldn't shake the feeling that there was a distinct connection between what these guys were going through, what the PUAs of the time were advocating, and the behavioral psychology I was becoming more and more saturated in. The average beta guys who were agonizing over their girlfriend problems and the behavioral basis upon which PUA techniques were founded had a common root in psychology. About this time, I had joined the online community at SoSuave.com. This forum would become my testing ground for connecting the dots I was beginning to become aware of. I should say that I did make an effort to propose that intergender relations were based in, sometimes harsh, behaviorism with colleagues and teachers. I was kind of taken aback more often than not when the same teachers who were promoting behavioral psychology as a hard science were the most outspoken critics of what I was bringing to light for them. I couldn't understand, then, what would possibly prevent them from connecting the dots and coming to the uncomfortable conclusions I was making. I know now, and you will too by the end of this book. But at the time, I hadn't figured out the influence the feminine imperative and romantic idealism had on their willingness to accept what I was proposing, in spite of their adherence to hard behaviorism. My inquiries and hashing out theories and ideas would have to be done on a forum where I could look for input, or maybe find that other men had concepts I hadn't considered, in a meeting place of similar ideas. So Suave was that forum for me for well over 12 years. Most of the concepts you will hear in this book are the result of over a decade of debate, critical inquiry, and refinement. However, in most cases, I still encourage their questioning, and none are unmodifiable or above further refinement. What you're about to hear are a refinement of the core ideas and concepts I formalized on my blog, The Rational Male. TheRationalMail.com. I began The Rational Male at the request of my readers on various men's forums and comments on blogs in the manosphere in 2011. After the popularity of the blog exploded inside a year, it became apparent that a book form of the basic principles was needed for new readers as I moved past them and built upon the prior concepts. For the most part, I've rewritten and edited for publishing the blog post of the first year at Rational Mail. I've left in most of the jingoisms and acronyms that are characteristic of the blog and are commonly used in the manosphere. For instance, SMV is sexual market value. However, I've made every attempt to define them as I go along. Furthermore, many of the concepts I explore in this book came from a question by one of my readers. As with most commenters, their anonymity is assumed in the form of their online handle. The important thing to remember is the concept being discussed and not so much the importance of who is proposing or contradicting a concept. Before you begin listening, the primary reason I decided to codify The Rational Male into a book came from a reader by the name of Jackie. Jackie was an older, married woman who genuinely took to what I proposed about intergender dynamics on Rational Male. Jackie wasn't exactly a typical reader for me, but she asked me to help her understand some concepts better so she could help her son, who was about to marry a woman whom she knew would be detrimental to his life. Jackie said, "I wish you had a book out with all of this stuff in it so I could give it to him. He's very beta and whipped, but if I had a book to put in his hands, he would read it." So it is for the sons of Jackie's that I decided to put this book out. And it's in this spirit that I'll need to ask you, the listener, to clear your head of a few things before you begin to digest any of it. The Rational Male literally has millions of readers worldwide. So there's a strong likelihood that you bought this book to keep on a shelf and loan to friends because you're already familiar with its concepts. There's a certain power and legitimacy that the printed word has that a blog or some online article lacks. So if you already are a rational male reader, be sure you do loan the book out, or encourage the plugged in to read and discuss it. If you are picking this book up for the first time, or had it handed to you by a friend or loved one, and have never heard of the rational male or the manosphere, or have had any exposure to the ideas I put forth here, I'll humbly ask that you listen with an open mind. That sounds like an easy cop-out. Open your mind. It kind of sounds like something a religious cult would preface their literature with. We all like to think we already have open minds and we're all perfectly rational and perfectly capable of critical thinking. I ask you to clear your head of the preconceptions you have of gender, because what you're about to hear are very radical concepts. Concepts that will challenge your perspective on women, men, how they interact with each other, and how social structures evolve around those relations. You will violently disagree with some of these concepts, and others will give you that aha moment of realization. Some of these concepts will grate on the investment your ego has in certain beliefs about how men and women ought to relate with each other, while others will validate exactly the experiences you may have had personally with them. Some are ugly. Some are not complimentary of women, and some of men. You'll think I'm a misogynist on first glance because it's the default response you've been taught to react with. For others, you might feel some kind of vindication for getting burned by your ex and realizing what was at play when it happened. I realize it's a tall order, but strive not to let your personal feelings color what I lay out for you here. You'll love me, and you'll hate me. You'll think, well, not in my case, and here's why. Or you'll think, wow, this is some really groundbreaking stuff. I'm not a psychologist, or a PUA, or a men's rights activist, or a motivational speaker. I'm just a guy who's connected some dots. Why do my eyes hurt? You've never used them before. Chapter 1. The Basics. The Soulmate Myth. There is no one. One-itis. An unhealthy romantic obsession with a single person, usually accompanied by unreciprocated affection and completely unrealistic idealization of the said person. One-itis is paralysis. You cease to mature. You cease to move. You cease to be you. There is no one. This is the soulmate myth. There are some good ones and some bad ones, but there is no one. Anyone telling you anything else is selling you something. There are lots of special someones out there for you. Just ask the divorced or widowed person who's remarried after their soulmate has died or moved on with another person they insist is their real soulmate. This is what trips people up about the soulmate myth. It is this fantasy that we all at least in some way share an idealization of, that there is one perfect mate for each of us. And as soon as the planets align and fate takes its course, we'll know that we're intended for each other. While this may make for a gratifying romantic comedy plot, it's hardly a realistic way to plan your life. In fact, it's usually paralyzing. What I find even more fascinating is how common the idea is, and particularly for guys, that a nuts and bolts view of life should be trumped by this fantasy in the area of intersexual relationships. Men who would otherwise recognize the value of understanding psychology, biology, sociology, evolution, business, engineering, etc., Men with a concrete awareness of the interplay who see these aspects take place in our lives on a daily basis are some of the first guys to become violently opposed to the idea that maybe there isn't someone for everyone. Or that there are a lot more ones out there that can meet or exceed the criteria we subconsciously set for them to be the one. I think it comes off as nihilistic, or this dread that maybe their ego investment in this belief is false. It's like saying God is dead to the deeply religious. It's just too terrible to contemplate that there may be no one. Or there may be several ones to spend their lives with. This Western romanticized mythology is based on the premise that there is only one perfect mate for any single individual, and as much as a lifetime can and should be spent in constant search of this soulmate. So strong and so pervasive is this myth in our collective consciousness that it has become akin to a religious statement, and in fact has been integrated into many religious doctrines as the feminization of Western culture has spread. I think there's been a mischaracterization of one-itis. It's necessary to differentiate between a healthy relationship based on mutual affinity and respect and a lopsided one-itis-based relationship. I've had more than a few guys seeking my advice or challenging my take on one-itis, essentially asking me for permission to accept one-itis as legitimate monogamy. But Rollo, it's got to be okay for a guy to have one-itis for his wife or girlfriend. After all, she's the one for him, right? In my estimation, one-itis is an unhealthy psychological dependency that is the direct result of the continuous socialization of the soulmate myth in our collective consciousness. What's truly frightening is that one-itis has become associated with being a healthy normative aspect of a long-term relationship, LTR, or marriage. I come to the conclusion that one-itis is based in sociological roots, not only due to it being a statement of personal belief, but by the degree to which this ideology is disseminated and mass marketed in popular culture through media, music, literature, movies, etc. Dating services like eHarmony shamelessly marketeer and exploit exactly the insecurities that this dynamic engenders in people desperately searching for the one they were intended for. The idea that men possess a natural capacity for protection, provisioning, and semi-monogamy has merit from both a social and biopsychological standpoint. But a one-itis psychosis is not a byproduct of it. Rather, I would set it apart from this healthy protector-provider dynamic, since one-itis essentially sabotages what our natural propensities would otherwise filter. One-itis is insecurity run amok while a person is single, and potentially paralyzing when coupled with the object of that one-itis in an LTR. The same neurotic desperation that drives a person to settle for their one, whether healthy or unhealthy, is the same insecurity that paralyzes them from abandoning a damaging relationship. This is their one, and how could they ever live without them? Or, they're my one, but all I need is to fix myself or fix them to have my idealized relationship. This idealization of a relationship is at the root of one-itis. With such a limiting, all-or-nothing binary approach to searching for one needle in the haystack, and investing emotional effort over the course of a lifetime, how do we mature into a healthy understanding of what that relationship should really entail? The very Pollyanna, idealized relationship, the happily ever after that belief in a one promotes as an ultimate end, is thwarted and contradicted by the cost of the constant pursuit of the one for which they'll settle for. After the better part of a lifetime is invested in this ideology, how much more difficult will it be to come to the realization that the person they're with isn't their one? To what extent will a person go in order to protect the lifetime of this ego investment? At some point in a one-itis relationship, one participant will establish dominance based on the powerlessness that this one-itis necessitates. There is no greater agency for a woman than to know beyond doubt that she is the only source of a man's need for sex and intimacy. A one-itis mindset only cements this into the understanding of both parties. For a man who believes that the emotionally and psychologically damaging relationship he has ego invested himself in is with the only person in his lifetime he's ever going to be compatible with, there is nothing more paralyzing in his maturation. The same, of course, holds true for women. And this is why we shake our heads when we see an exceptionally beautiful woman go chasing back to her abusive and indifferent jerk boyfriend, because she believes he is her one and the only source of security available to her. Hypergamy may be her rude imperative for sticking with him, but it's the soulmate myth, the fear of the one that got away, that makes for the emotional, almost spiritual, investment. The definition of power is not financial success, status, or influence over others, but the degree to which we have control over our own lives. Subscribing to the soulmate mythology necessitates that we recognize powerlessness in this area of our lives. Better, I think it would be to foster a healthy understanding that there is no one. There are some good ones and there are some bad ones, but there is no one. Religion of the Soulmate. What you've just listened to was one of my earliest posts back on the So Suave forums from around 2003 to 2004. I was finishing my degree then and had the fallacy of the one graphically illustrated for me in a psychology class one day. I was in class, surrounded by mostly much younger students than myself, all very astute and as intellectual as they come for mid-20-somethings. At one point, the discussion had come around to religion, and much of the class expressed being agnostic or atheist, or spiritual but not religious. The rationale was, of course, that religion and belief could be explained as psychological, fear of mortality, constructs that were expanded to sociological dynamics. Later in that discussion, the idea of a soulmate came up. The professor didn't actually use the word soul, but rather couched the idea by asking for a show of hands as to how many of the class believed there was a special someone out there for them, or if they feared the one that got away. Damn near the entire class raised their hands. For all of their rational empiricism and appeals to realism in regards to spirituality, they almost unanimously expressed a quasi-karmic belief in connecting with another idealized person on an intimate level for a lifetime. Even the frat guys and hookup girls who I knew weren't expressly looking for anything long-term in their dating habits still raised their hands in assent to a belief in a one. Some later explained what that one meant to them, and most had differing definitions of that idealization. Some even admitted to it being an idealization as the discussion progressed. Yet almost all of them still had what would otherwise be termed an irrational belief in predestination, or, even amongst the least spiritual, that it's just part of life to pair off with someone significant and there was someone for everyone. This discussion was the catalyst for one of my awakening realizations. Despite all odds, people largely feel entitled to, or deserving of, an important love of their life. Statistically and pragmatically, this is ridiculous. But there it is. The feminized Disneyfication of this core concept has been romanticized and commercialized to the point of it becoming a religion, even for the expressly non-religious. The Shakespearean longing for the one. The search for another soul, mate, who was destined to be our match, has been systematically distorted beyond all reason. And, as I'll elaborate later, men will take their own lives in the delusion of having lost their soulmate. Soulmate men. This perversion of the soulmate myth is attributable to a large part of the feminized social conventions we deal with today. The fear of isolation from our imagined soulmate, or the fear of having irrecoverably lost that perfect one for us, fuels so much of the personal and social neuroses we find in the contemporary matrix of our society. For example, much of the fear inherent in the myth of the lonely old man loses its teeth without a core belief in the soulmate myth. The fear of loss and the delusions of relational equity only really matter when the person men believe that equity should influence is their predestined one. The feminine imperative recognized the overwhelming power the soulmate myth had over men and women from the beginnings of its rise to ascendancy as the primary gender social imperative. Virtually all of the distortions of the core soulmate dynamic evolved as a controlling schema for men. When it is soulmate women who are the primary reward for a soulmate necessitous man, there are a lot of opportunities to consolidate that power upon. To be clear, don't think this is some fiendish plot of a femcentric cabal socially engineering that soulmate fear into men. Generations of men, raised to be oblivious to it, willingly and actively help perpetuate the soulmate myth. Soulmate women. Although hypergamy plays a large role in determining what makes for an idealized soulmate for women, they aren't immune to the exploitations of that core fear. Though it's more an unfortunate byproduct than an outright manipulation, I'd argue that in some ways hypergamy intensifies that neurosis. An alpha widow knows all too well the languishing associated with pining for the alpha that got away, particularly when she's paired off long-term with the dutiful beta provider after her sexual market value, SMV, declines. For women, the soulmate represents that nigh unattainable combination of arousing alpha dominance matched with a loyal providership for her long-term security that only she can tame out of him. Hypergamy hates the soulmate principle because the soulmate is an absolute definition, whereas hypergamy must always test for perfection. Hypergamy asks, is he the one? Is he the one? And the soulmate myth replies, he has to be the one. He's your soulmate, and there's only one of those. Building the mystery. Due to this core concept in the soulmate mythology, both sexes will seek to perfect that idealization for themselves, even under the least ideal of conditions and expressions. We want to build our intimate relations into that soulmate idealism in order to relieve the fear and solve the problem. And most times so badly that we'll deftly ignore the warnings, abuses, and consequences of having done so. For women, the impact of the most significant alpha male is what initially defines that soulmate idealization. For men, it may be the first woman to become sexual with him, or the one who best exemplifies a woman he mistakenly believes can love him in a male-defined orientation of love. However, these are the points of origin for building that soulmate ideal upon. This ideal is compounded upon with layers of investments in the hopes that this person might actually be the one fate has prescribed for them. Emotional investment, personal, financial, even life potential investments and sacrifices then follow in an effort to create a soulmate. In the absence of an ideal, one must be created from available resources. This process is why I say the soulmate myth is ridiculous. It's psychologically much more pragmatic to construct another person to fit that ideal than it ever will be to wait for fate to take its course. People subscribing to the myth would rather build a soulmate, consequences be damned. So women will attempt to build a better beta, or tame down an alpha, while men will attempt to turn a whore into a housewife, or vice versa. One of the most bitter aftertastes to having awakened to the red pill truth is abandoning old paradigms for new. I've described this before as akin to killing an old friend. And one friend that needs killing is exactly this mythology. Disabusing yourself of this core fear is vital to fully unplugging yourself from the old paradigm. Because so much of femme-centric social conditioning is dependent upon it. Dropping the soulmate myth isn't the nihilism a lot of people might have you believe it is. If anything, it will free you to have a better, healthier future relationship with someone who is genuinely important to you. A relationship based on genuine desire, mutual respect, complementary understanding of each other, and love. Rather than one based on a fear of losing your one and only representation of contentment in this life. The cardinal rule of relationships. In any relationship, the person with the most power is the one who needs the other the least. This is a foundation of any relationship. Not just intersexual ones, but family, business, etc. relationships as well. It is a dynamic that is always in effect. For my own well-being and that of my family's, I need my employer more than he needs me. Ergo, I get up for work in the morning and work for him. And while I am also a vital part for the uninterrupted continuance of his company and endeavors, he simply needs me less than I need him. Now I could win the lottery tomorrow, or he may decide to cut my pay or limit my benefits. Or I may complete my master's degree and decide that I can do better than to keep myself yoked to his cart indefinitely. Thereby, through some condition, either initiated by myself or not, I am put into a position of needing him less than he needs me. At this point, he is forced into a position of deciding how much I am worth to his ambitions and either part ways with me or negotiate a furtherance of our relationship. The same plays true for intersexual relationships. Whether you want to base your relationship on power or not isn't the issue. It's already in play from your first point of attraction. You are acceptable to her for meeting any number of criteria, and she meets your own as well. If this weren't the case, you simply would not initiate a mutual relationship. This is the first comparison we make with another individual. Call it sizing up if you like. But we make innate, and often unconscious, comparisons about everything. And in the case of initial attraction, we decide if the other person is acceptable for our own intimacy. This principle isn't so much about power as it is about control. This might sound like semantics, but it makes a difference. It's very easy to slip into binary arguments and think that what I mean by the cardinal rule of relationships is that one participant must absolutely rule over the other. A domineering dominant to a doormat submissive. The problem with our modern interpretation of power is to think of it in extreme, absolute terms. Control in a healthy relationship passes back and forth as desire and need dictate for each partner. In an unhealthy relationship, you have an unbalanced manipulation of this control by a partner. Although control is never in complete balance, it becomes manipulation when one partner, in essence, blackmails the other with what would otherwise be a reinforcer for the manipulated under a healthy circumstance. This happens for a plethora of different reasons, but the condition comes about by two ways. The submissive participant becomes conditioned to allow the manipulation to occur, and or the dominant initiates the manipulation. In either case, the rule still holds true. The one who needs the other the least has the most control. Nowhere is this more evident than in interpersonal relationships. Too many people who have counseled and read my blog assume that this rule means that I'm advocating the maintaining a position of dominance at the expense of their partner's best interest. Far from it. I do, however, advocate that people, young men in particular, develop a better sense of self-worth and a better understanding of their true efficacy in their relationships, assuming you decide to become involved in one. Don't get me wrong. Both sexes are guilty of manipulation. Battered women go back to their abusive boyfriends or husbands, and pussy-whipped men compromise themselves and their ambitions to better serve their girlfriends' insecurities. My intent in promoting this rule is to open the eyes of young men who are already predisposed to devaluing themselves and placing women as the goal of their lives, rather than seeing themselves as the prize to be sought after. Compromise is always going to be a part of any relationship. But what's key is realizing when that compromise becomes the result of manipulation. What is in effect and developing the confidence to be uncompromising in those situations. This is where a firm understanding of the cardinal rule of relationships becomes essential. There's nothing wrong with backing down from an argument you have with your girlfriend. But there is something wrong when you continually compromise yourself in order to keep the peace with the understanding that she'll withhold intimacy as a result of you holding your ground. That is a power play, also known as a shit test. She initiates it, thus becoming the controlling party. No woman's intimacy, sex, is ever worth that compromise, because in doing so, you devalue your own worth to her. Once this precedent is set, she will progressively have less respect for you. Exactly the opposite of the popular conception that she'll appreciate your compromising for her and reward you for this. And really, what are you compromising in order to achieve? Said in this condition, you're appealing for her intimacy. That isn't genuine desire or real interest in you. It's a subtle psychological test that all too many men are unaware of, meant to determine who needs the other more. There is no more a superior confidence for a man than one with the self-understanding that he will not compromise himself for the recognized manipulations of a woman, and the fortitude to walk away knowing he has in the past and will in the future find a better prospect than her. This is the man who passes the shit test. It's called enlightened self-interest, and a principle I wholly endorse. Truth to power. Denying the utility of power, vilifying its usages, is in itself a means of using power. Real change works from the inside out. If you don't change your mind about yourself, you won't change anything else. Women can change their hair color, their makeup, clothes, breast size, and any number of cosmetic alteration on a whim, or as they can afford them. But the constant discontent, the constant inadequacies they complain of are rooted in their self-perceptions, not how others really perceive them. This is an outside-in mentality, hoping the external will change the internal. And it's just this mentality that lesser men apply to themselves. The only difference being the application. The average frustrated chump, AFC for lack of a better term, has the same problem as the vain woman. Okay, really any woman. A lack of true self-understanding of their own problem. It's very difficult to do self-analysis and self-criticism, particularly when it comes to questioning our own beliefs and the reasons our personalities are what they are. It's akin to telling someone they're not living their lives correctly or they're raising their children wrong. Only it's more difficult because we're doing the telling about ourselves to ourselves. Self-estimation, not self-esteem, never happens spontaneously. There always has to be some crisis to prompt it. Anxiety, trauma, and crisis are necessary catalysts to stimulate self-consciousness. A breakup, a death, a betrayal. Tragically, it's at these points in our lives that we do our best introspection. We have our moments of clarity and, yes, discover what abysmal, simpering chumps we've allowed ourselves to be molded into. Denial. The first step to really unplugging from our preconditioning, the feminine matrix, is recognizing that this conditioning has led to the beliefs we think are integral to our personalities. The psychological term for this is called ego investment. When a person internalizes a mental schema so thoroughly and has become conditioned to it for so long, it becomes an integral part of their personality. So to attack the belief is to, literally, attack the person. This is why we see such a violent reaction to people's political, religious, intersocial, intersexual, intergender, etc. expressions of belief. They perceive it as a personal attack, even when presented with irrefutable, empirical evidence that challenges the veracity of those beliefs. One common frustration that game-aware men express is how difficult it is to open an AFC's eyes as to why he's not hooking up, why he's not getting dates, or second dates if he is, why he's constantly getting, let's just be friends, LJBF, rejections, etc. And all the flaws in what is really ego investment internalizations. As I'm fond of saying, it's dirty work unplugging chumps from the matrix. And this is made all the more difficult when a person is in a categorical state of denial. People resort to denial when recognizing the truth would destroy something they hold dear. In the case of a cheating partner, denial lets you avoid acknowledging evidence of your own humiliation. Short of catching your spouse in bed with your best friend, evidence of infidelity is usually ambiguous. It's motivated skepticism. You're more skeptical of things you don't want to believe and demand a higher level of proof. Denial is unconscious, or it wouldn't work. If you know you're closing your eyes to the truth, some part of you knows what the truth is, and denial can't perform its protective function. One thing we all struggle to protect is a positive self-image. The more important the aspect of your self-image that's challenged by the truth, the more likely you are to go into denial. If you have a strong sense of self-worth and competence, your self-image can take hits but remain largely intact. If you're beset by self-doubt, however, a hallmark of self-righteous AFC thinking, any acknowledgement of failure can be devastating and any admission of error painful to the point of being unthinkable. Self-justification and denial arise from the dissonance between believing you're competent and making a mistake, which clashes with that image. Solution: deny the mistake. Attribute it to an outside element. Women won't play by the rules. Rather than resort to introspection, maybe I'm wrong about the rules? Therefore, we see AFCs tenaciously cling to a moralistic sense of purpose in their methods, which is only reinforced by popular culture in our media, our music, eHarmony, our religion, etc. Articles of Power. The term power has a lot of misapplied connotations to it. When we think of powerful people, we think of influence, wealth, prestige, status, and the ability to have others do our bidding. All of these are not power. As much as we'd like to convince ourselves that women are attracted to this definition of power, this is false. Because what I've described as aspects of power here are really manifestations of power. Here's a cosmic secret revealed for you. Real power is the degree to which a person has control over their own circumstances. Real power is the degree to which we actually control the directions of our lives. When we allow our thinking, our personality disorders, and our mental schemas, combined with their accompanying behaviors, to determine the course of our decisions, we relinquish real power. The man who succumbs, by force or by will, to the responsibilities, liabilities, and accountabilities that are required of him by society, marriage, commitment, family, fatherhood, career choice, the military, etc., leaves him very little influence over the course of his own life. The painter Paul Gauguin is one of history's most powerful men. At middle age, Paul was a successful banker, with a wife and children, and by all appearances, a man of great merit and considerable wealth. Then one day, Paul decided he'd had enough and wanted to paint. He left his wife, children, and his money, and decided he would become a painter. He cast off his former life to live the life he chose. He had the power to assume control of it. Eventually, he died in Tahiti, but not after having one of the most interesting of lives and becoming a world-renowned painter. You may think, what a horrible man he was to abandon his responsibilities to selfishly pursue his own desires. But the fact remains that he had the power within himself to do so that most men would shudder to even consider. So entrapped are we in our self-expectation and self-imposed limitations that we fail to see that we have always had the keys to our own prisons. We're just scared shitless to use them. This power is the root of that all-important term confidence we toss out every time we tell a 19-year-old chump what women really want so he can get laid. It's this ability to make our own decisions, right or wrong, and to confidently own them that separate us from other guys. It's this self-guided power that evokes a seemingly irrational confidence to spin plates, to date non-exclusively, to assert ourselves, and to be unafraid to make ourselves the prize. And it's just this power that women want to be associated with. Lack of this power is exactly what makes master pickup artists, PUAs, revert to some of the most pathetic AFCs once they become involved in an LTR. They sell women on this idealization and the perception that they possess this power, only to discover the AFC insecurities these behaviors were meant to cover up once they bought the act. This isn't to devalue PUA skills as effective behavior sets. Rather, it's meant to illustrate the behaviors that should be manifest as a result of effecting a real personal change. It should be that adopting a positive masculine mental schema prompts these PUA skills as a result. Instead, we have the cart before the horse in a mad rush to get that all-important pussy we've been deprived of for so long. By masking our deficit in real power and understanding with rote memorized PUA techniques, hoping that by practicing them, they'll turn into natural game and will mature enough to initiate a lasting personal change. We'll return to this later. Chapter 1 continued. Part 2. The Desire Dynamic. You cannot negotiate genuine desire. This is a very simple principle that most men and the vast majority of women are willfully ignorant of. One of the most common personal problems I've been asked advice for in the past 10 years is some variation of, how do I get her back? Usually this breaks down into men seeking some methodology to return his relationship to an earlier state where a previously passionate woman couldn't keep her hands off of him. 6 months into a comfortable familiarity, and the thrill is gone. But in truth, it's the genuine desire that is gone. It's often at this stage that a man will resort to negotiation. Sometimes this can be as subtle as him progressively and systematically doing things for her in the hopes that she'll reciprocate in the same sexual, intimate fervor they used to have. Other times, a married or long-term couple may go to couples counseling to resolve their sex issues and negotiate terms for her sexual compliance. He'll promise to do the dishes and a load of laundry more often in exchange for her feigned sexual interest in him. Yet, no matter what terms are offered, no matter how great an external effort he makes so deserving of reward, the genuine desire is not there for her. In fact, she feels worse for not having the desire after such efforts were made for her compliance. Her desire has become an obligation. Negotiated desire only ever leads to obligated compliance. This is why her post-negotiation sexual response is often so lackluster, and the source of even further frustration on his part. She may be more sexually available to him, but the half-hearted experience is never the same as when they first met when there was no negotiation. Just spontaneous desire for each other. From a male perspective, and particularly that of an uninitiated beta male, negotiation of desire seems a deductive, rational solution to the problem. Men tend to innately rely on deductive reasoning, otherwise known as an if-then logic stream. The code is often something like this. I need sex. Plus, women have the sex I want. Plus, query women about their conditions for sex, plus meet prerequisites for sex, equals the sex I want. Makes sense, right? It's simple deductive pragmatism. but built on a foundation that relies on a woman's accurate self-evaluation. The genuine desire they used to experience at the outset of their relationship was predicated upon a completely unknown set of variables. Overtly communicating a desire for reciprocal desire creates obligation, and sometimes even ultimatums. Genuine desire is something a person must come to or be led to of their own volition. You can force a woman by threat to comply with behaving in a desired manner, but you cannot make her want to behave that way. A prostitute will fuck you for an exchange. It doesn't mean she wants to. Whether in a monogamous marriage, LTR, or a one-night stand, ONS. Strive for genuine desire in your relationships. Half of the battle is knowing you want to be with a woman who wants to please you, not one who feels obligated to. You will never draw this genuine desire from her by overt means, but you can covertly lead her to this genuine desire. The trick in provoking real desire is keeping her ignorant of your intent to provoke it. Real desire is created by her thinking it's something she wants, not something she has to do. Imagination. A woman's imagination is the single most useful tool in your game arsenal. Every technique, every casual response, every gesture, intimation, and subcommunication hinges on stimulating a woman's imagination. Competition anxiety relies on it. Demonstrating higher value, DHV, relies on it. Prompting sexual tension relies on it. Call it caffeinating the hamster, if you will. But stimulating a woman's imaginings is the single most potent talent you can develop in any context of a relationship. This is the single greatest failing of average frustrated chumps. They vomit out everything about themselves, divulging the full truth of themselves to women in the mistaken belief that women desire that truth as a basis for qualifying for their intimacy. Learn this now. Women never want full disclosure. Nothing is more self-satisfying for a woman than to think she's figured a man out based solely on her mythical feminine intuition, i.e. imagination. When a man overtly confirms his character, his story, his value, etc. for a woman, the mystery is dispelled and the biochemical rush she enjoyed from her imaginings, her suspicions, her self-confirmations about you are gone. Most guys with a beta male mindset classically do exactly this on the first date and wonder why they get LJBF'd promptly after it. This is why. Familiarity is anti-seductive. Nothing kills game, organic passion, and libido like comfortable familiarity. Despite their common filibuster tactics, women don't want to be comfortable with a potential or proven sex partner. They need their imagination stoked to be excited, aroused, and anxious to want sex with a potential partner. In an LTR, there's an even more critical need to keep prodding that imagination. I would go so far as to say it's imperative for a healthy relationship. But then you'll ask, how do you go about that when your LTR girlfriend or wife already knows your story and the familiarity becomes cemented in? The easy answer is never let it be from the outset. The health of any LTR you might entertain depends and survives on the frame you enter into it with. The foundations of a healthy LTR are laid while you're single and dating non-exclusively. I've yet to meet the guy who's told me he's getting more frequent, more intense sex after his LTR or marriage or live-in situation was established. The primary reason for this is the relaxation of the competition anxiety that made the urgency of fucking you with lustful abandon in your dating phase an imperative to get you to commit to her frame. That's the crux of the matter that so many guys fail in. They surrender the frame before they commit to an LTR. They believe, thanks to their feminine